Okay, we've been studying the life of David. And we have worked our way up now, actually finally got him into the storyline, because we started at the first of 1 Samuel, and he's not there yet. But we finally got him in the storyline in chapter 16, and we saw him come on the scene and start playing the role that God wanted him to play. How is it that David got to be the second king of Israel? Did they have a national election and he campaigned for it like's going on here? Is that how he got to be that? No, he got...
He was anointed.
He was anointed, but before his anointing, what happened? How did he get to that point? God elected him, right? Yeah. David was elected second king of Israel by God. And as you say, anointed by Samuel, God's servant, the last of the prophets. Samuel is sort of the bridge guy between the era of the judges, 330 years and a dozen different judges, and the era of the kings, about another 400 years and about 23 or 24 different kings. So he's the guy that God used to bridge between those two eras in Israel's history. He was God's anointed judge, and he anointed then 1 Samuel and then David as king of Israel. Did David immediately take over the kingship of Israel, being anointed as a young man? No, he's going to go through a period of training before God gives him that role. And it's going to be probably maybe 15 years, 10 to 15 years, something like that. And but God brings him into the court of Saul kind of right away. Remember how that happened? Was it because of his military prowess that David was recruited into the court of Saul?
Musical.
No? Yeah, his musical abilities, wasn't it? That seems a little bit different than a warrior like David is recruited into Saul's service because he can play the harp. Now, why did that matter? Well, you remember how God set all of this up? He sent a demon to torment Saul. He removed his spirit from Saul and sent a demon instead to torment Saul. And the only relief Saul could get from that torment was when somebody played some harp music. Not sure how they understood that, but at any rate, they did. And somebody in Saul's presence remembered David. David was a harpist, among other things. So they got him, brought him in, and he started playing for Saul, and he helped him. And so David was brought into Saul's court via the route of being a musician, as compared to a warrior like he later became. And he did well. He was well liked, not only by Saul, but by just the Israelites in general. The whole nation liked that young man. He had a lot of good qualities, and he was well liked, well respected young man. He had good priorities in life, did he not, for a young man? When he first encountered Goliath, he was offended that Goliath was insulting the God of Israel. Most young guys in their late teens could care less about whether God's being insulted or not. But David was. He was offended. He said, I'm not going to let that guy get away with this stuff. And he proceeded then to display great faith in God and stepping out to confront this giant of a man, literally a giant of a man, nearly 10 feet tall. And unfortunately, he was well armored except for his forehead. And David planted a rock on his forehead that knocked him to the ground. Might have killed him. I don't know. I don't know if that killed him or if chopping his head off killed him. I think chopping his head off did kill him. I'm not sure if the rock did. But the rock might have killed him. I don't know. Anyway, it knocked him down. David chops his head off with his own sword and illustrated the providential workings of God in the affairs of men when there is no other explanation for the accounting of that other than God's work. The human circumstances set up in that confrontation was such that David didn't have a prayer. No way in the world he can defeat that man apart from divine help. And that's what he did have, and that's how he did indeed defeat Goliath and exhibited just extraordinary faith for a young man in the early part of his life. And he also then developed quite a friendship with Saul's son, Jonathan. Jonathan was quite a bit older than David, but he was just like him, it looks like in Scripture. He was a godly young man. He was brave. He was a warrior. And those two guys are just pretty much like one another. And Jonathan recognized that David was going to be the king of Israel, and he wanted to serve him when that day came. And so he kind of made a covenant with David, and those two got along just really well. So chapter 16 and 17 paint a nice, positive picture of David's start in public life. When David was walking by faith, is it a fair statement to say that he was doing well? Defeating Goliath, winning the affections of Saul, winning the affections of the nation as a whole. Walking by faith invokes the blessings of God on our life. David did that, and he was on the receiving end of those blessings. And so our first encounter with David was very positive, and it was marked by a life of faith. We want to continue on here this morning. In chapter 18, things start to deteriorate somewhat. Remember, he got off to a very good working relationship with Saul. Saul loved him, it said. But we'll see how things continue on here in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. We'll pick up at verse 5. Okay? So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. Now, this is quite an achievement for a young man to be set over some of these grizzled veterans of warfare, that David, this young whippersnapper, is now over them. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. How many situations do you know of in life where a young man comes in, takes charge over a bunch of older veteran guys, and they like him? Not very many, huh? But David had unusual qualities that made him a very likable, admirable young man. So he's doing extremely well. And it happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that the women came out, all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. Now, I could be a smart aleck and say, well, what happens after is all because of women. But I won't say that. No, that would be smart alecky. So here's the women coming out as David returns from these battles and these victories. And the women sang as they played, and they said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Uh-oh. Now, normally in this society and at this time, no one would care what women are saying about anything. They had no voice in anything, socially or domestically or anything else. So normally, a veteran politician like Saul could maybe just sort of turn a deaf ear to this stuff and ignore it. Who cares what the women are saying? But he can't do that. He can't let it go. What the women are saying is, Saul, you're pretty good, but David, he's real good. Saul, you ain't as good as David. And he can't let it go. He can't just say, why do I care what the women are singing? It's just a song they made up. Let it go. Forget it. But he can't. Look at verse 8. He became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me, they've only ascribed thousands. Now, what more has he? What more can he have but the kingdom? Geez, if he's already getting the admiration and praise of all the women, there's only one thing left that he doesn't have, and that's the whole kingdom. So Saul is unable to swallow this with a little bit of grace, with a little bit of tolerance, and just leave it go. That green-head monster takes a nice big chomp out of him, and he's jealous of David because these women have praised him, David, more than Saul. And Saul looked on David with suspicion from that day on. Seems to me like back in chapter 16, that David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly. Boy, that didn't last very long, did it? Now, you see, Saul is becoming engulfed in this jealousy concerning David, and his feelings toward him have taken an abrupt turn to the south, and he now suspects David. He's suspicious of him, when his initial reaction was he loved the guy. Now remember, from time to time, we know that this demon is oppressing Saul. He's got a mental/psychological malady of some kind. I don't know if we could put a label on it per se, but he's got some mental instability at work in his life. And this demon is probably exacerbating it with whatever torment he's bringing on him. So I guess it shouldn't shock us to see Saul showing some bipolarism or something like that in his attitude toward David, and we certainly see that here. So it came about on the next day, I'm in 1 Samuel 18:10, that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Now, the emphasis upon the hand here is kind of interesting. In it, on the one case, you got David, and in his hand is a musical instrument, an item of peace and comfort and harmony and all that kind of stuff. But in Saul's hand is a spear. And the two instruments almost kind of reflect the personalities of the two men at this point in time. Saul is raving. He's losing it. He's becoming a lunatic. And David is just peacefully playing his harp. And verse 11, Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I'll pin David to the wall. He goes to that extreme and actually tries to literally use David for a pin and stick him into the wall with this spear. Throws his spear at his beloved David. But David escaped from his presence twice. I take it he threw the spear at him twice. Good for David. He's pretty fleet of foot, apparently. Pretty agile. And gets away from being impaled by Saul. Now, that kind of stuff, that kind of fits right in line with evil spirit activities and so on, doesn't it? Trying to kill somebody, trying to throw a spear at them. I don't know how much of this we can attribute to Saul himself and how much of it is the influence from this evil spirit. There's so much a part and parcel of the same package now that it's hard to say. But clearly, Saul has deteriorated, his mental state has deteriorated rapidly and badly. And as I say, probably accelerated by this demonic stuff. Therefore, Saul removed. Now, Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but he departed from Saul. So Saul now is actually fearing David. And Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. I suspect David didn't mind that demotion, huh? Get me out of the presence of this crazy guy. Let me go out into the field and manage the military activities there rather than in Saul's presence. So he gets sort of shuffled back out of Saul's presence now. And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. And Saul saw that he was prospering greatly. He dreaded him. Clearly, I mean, stop and think for a moment. If you were Saul and one of your primary commanders serving you faithfully was doing well, you would dread that? Would not be that be a boon to your administration to have a young man like that doing so well on your behalf? But Saul dreads David's success. He dreads seeing the blessing of God on David's life because it's not on his. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. So David is progressing nicely, while Saul, on the other hand, is deteriorating rather rapidly, and the relationship between Saul and David has deteriorated very badly as well. Again, some of it perhaps demonically influenced, some of it I don't know how you explain mental disorders and things like that at times, but something like that is going on with Saul, and he is on a downward spin, unfortunately, and it's unpleasant to see, to be sure. All right, so the situation now is that David appears to be walking by faith in life and doing well. Saul, on the other hand, is becoming a wreck of a human being. So Saul says to David, verse 17, "Here's my older daughter, Merab. I'll give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles." Well, remember, he'd already promised that whoever could take Goliath down would get his older wife. So this is a promise that he's already reneged on once already. She should have already been given to David as a result of that victory. So he lied about that. But here's his thinking. "For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. I'll just send him out there to battle and let the Philistines kill off this young whippersnapper. I won't have to do it. I'll let them do it." So he's using his daughter as just a pawn to try to, in essence, bring about the death of David through military battle by saying, "You go out there and fight these guys and I'll give you my daughter." But David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law?" In other words, he's demurring and he's saying, "Hey, I don't have either the financial wherewithal or the social status to be the king's son-in-law. I can't pay a decent dowry. My family ain't got enough money to come up with one." He says, I'm not worthy of this honor, and I thanks but no thanks type answer. So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David. He could have said, "I don't need a dowry. She's yours. Just take her. Take her and be a good husband to her, and that's all I want." But that's not what his intentions was. He wanted to get David killed by working for her. So he gives her someone else. Gives her this guy named Meholathite, or Adriel is the name. He is a Meholathite for a wife. So the wife that should have gone to David goes to another guy, because Saul's plan was just to use her as a pawn to kill David. And when that fell apart, he didn't care that David got her. Give her to somebody else. Now, Michal, Saul's other daughter, she would be the younger of the two, loved David. And when they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him. He says he's probably thinking, plan B. I got another daughter who's interested in him. I'll just use her to accomplish the same thing. So Saul thought, verse 21, I'll give her to him that she may become a snare to him. Obviously worried about the well-being of his daughter, huh? She's a snare. That's all she is to him. That the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. So he says, let's go to plan B. I'll give you my other daughter, since you could not assume the first one. So Saul commanded his servants and said, speak to David secretly, saying, behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So David says to Saul tells his servants, go out and lie to David on the sly and tell him that I really do want him to be my son-in-law. So he invokes his servants to go out and lie for him to David, kind of a roundabout way instead of him telling him directly. So Saul's servant spoke these words to David, but David said, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? Again, demurring over the fact that he doesn't have sufficient wherewithal to pay a good dowry and do the other socially acceptable things of that day. And so the servants of Saul report back to him according to these words which David spoke. So he says, they go back and report to David, hey, he doesn't want to be your son-in-law because he doesn't feel like he's worthy. He doesn't have the money to pay a good dowry and all that. So Saul says, well, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. An odd dowry, to be sure. I can make all kinds of jokes about this, but I'm not going to. It's too painful to even think about making jokes about this. Now, Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Same plan. He says, but now you got to go out and kill these guys and bring proof to me of their death, of 100 of them. Now, when his servants told these words to David, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. He says, hey, I can handle this. This involves warfare. This is my shtick. This is right up my alley. I can take care of this. So he said, I don't have to go raise up a bunch of money that I don't have. I just have to go out and kill these 100 Philistines. So before the days had expired, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. So David goes out and raises this odd dowry, twice what over what Saul had asked for, and therefore he has then something to offer that pleased Saul, although the intent was never to just simply raise a dowry. It was try to get David to wake up dead. So when Saul and knew that the Lord was with David and that Saul's daughter loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. So we've gone from Saul loving David to suspecting David to throwing spears at him to being his enemy continually. That's what you kind of call a deterioration of relationship, isn't it? To go from loving him to being his continual enemy and everything in between. So clearly the relationship between David and Saul has deteriorated drastically. So then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so his name was highly esteemed. David is earning the respect and admiration of the people of Israel through his superior conduct. He's making Saul look like some kind of a rank rookie in when it comes to government and warfare, and the people see that in him, and he is prospering well. So, I'll repeat again. While David is walking by faith, he's doing very well. The Lord is blessing his life. He's rising in the esteem of the people. Saul, walking by mental disability, is declining and deteriorating rapidly. But he has a wife now, so he has at least gotten that. So far, his training seems to involve trying to cope with the degrading madness of Saul and sort of keeping one eye on him, not turning your back on him, as he tries to serve in Saul's administration. So, a period of training going on for David involving a rather difficult, almost life, well, it is life-threatening relationship with Saul. Chapter 19. Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all his servants to put David to death. Remember the relationship between between Jonathan and David? It's a very good one, very positive one. You think this is going to go over real well? Telling the guy that loves David as much as another man probably could to kill him? Saul greatly delighted, Jonathan greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father is seeking to put you to death. So he goes and explains to David that there's an all-out attempt now to kill David off. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak with my father about you. And if I find out anything, then I shall tell you. So David hides in some kind of a cave-like thing or something, I don't know, some sort of place or some sort of a refuge. And Jonathan is going to talk to Saul about him and see if there's some agreement they can come to about him and not killing him. So Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, do not let the king sin against your servant David, since he's not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand, he struck the Philistine, probably referring to Goliath, and the Lord brought him a great deliverance from all Israel. And you saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? Very logical, straightforward, truthful statements about David and his servants to Saul. And so Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Verse 6. Saul promises, okay, Jonathan, you've convinced me. I've been wrong about David. He is not going to be put to death. He is safe. He's okay. Now, what you've seen in Saul so far, would you bet the farm on this guy? I'd be a little suspect if I was David of anything Saul had to say. So then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. I bet he wasn't taking any naps in his presence. But at any rate, he has moved back into the court of Saul, right close to him again. So when there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter, so that they fled before him. And there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house, and a spear was in his hand. Yikes. And David was playing the harp with his hand. Stop me if you've heard this before. And Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear again. Now, this is at least the third time we know of that he's chucked this spear at David. But David slipped away out of Saul's presence, so they struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Yeah, that verse 6 lasted a long time in Saul's thinking, didn't it? Yeah, David's not going to be killed. You can bring him in. I promise. He must have had his fingers crossed behind his back, because the first opportunity he gets, he throws a spear at him. But notice now, in this case, it's quite clear this was a result of this demon oppression. Whatever's going on here, this demonic activity is wearing this guy out. And so, once again, David escapes an attempt on his life by Saul. So, the first attempt to protect David was through Jonathan. There's a second attempt here to protect him through his wife, Michal. Verse 11 of 1 Samuel 19. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death. He's persisting in this, Saul is. In the morning, but Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death. So his wife intervenes and tells David that Saul is trying to kill him the next morning, I guess when he left the house or whatever. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Kind of reminds you of Saul in Damascus, doesn't it? Let down through the basket, in a basket outside the window. So Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed. It's a rather interesting statement, isn't it? What is this household idol doing in David's household? And apparently this is a pretty good size one, because they're using it to represent a human body, and so it must have been of some... You could not see the thing. It's prominent. So she has this idol in her house, and David's house, and he has tolerated that, strangely enough. Put it on the bed, put a quilt of goat's hair on its head, and covered it with clothes. In other words, tried to simulate a body lying in bed using this large statue-like thing that could simulate a body. Now, when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. Now, unfortunately, Michal is not above lying to her father to try to protect David. Now, is this lie okay? Is this a justifiable lie? Is this a case where the end justifies the means? It looks that way. He's going to get away. It looks like her lie was a good thing. Does the end ever justify the means if it involves sin? No, it does not. Lying is never good. Why then does God use it to help David. Did God bless that sin? Or does God use the unrighteousness of men from time to time to accomplish his will? After all, what else is he going to use for men? The righteousness of men? When Abraham went down to Egypt, he lied about his wife Sarah, and yet he came out of there with tons of money in his pocket. God blessed him greatly. Does that mean that lie was okay because God blessed Abraham? What else came out of Egypt with him besides all that money? Hagar, his handmaid. And who came out of her? Ishmael, the Arabs. Was that a good deal?
Still not.
They've been killing one another for 3,500 years since then. It looked on the surface like that lie was blessed by God, that it was a good thing, that the end did justify the means. It looked that way until you looked at it a little more closely. The end never justifies the means. If it involves sin, sin is never okay. Sometimes God uses sinful behavior of men, people in general, to accomplish his will. But that doesn't mean that he approves of sin. Sin is an offense to God. It is an abhorrence to him. So he just uses this situation here, but doesn't bless it. It's not something that he wants. But she lies. She's an idolater and a liar. So there are some personality traits there that aren't good. So at any rate, she sets up this ruse and says, well, he's sick. So Saul sends messengers to see David saying, well, bring him to me on his bed that I may put him to death. So if he's too sick to come to me, just pick the whole bed up and bring it in here. I'll kill him laying in the bed. Where there's a will, there's a way. So the messengers entered, and behold, the household idol was lying on the bed and the quilt of goat's hair at its head. And they're probably thinking, oh, man, this gal done went and deceived us, and he ain't here. So Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped? And if one lie is good, two lies have to be better. She says, well, he told me that if I didn't help him, he'd kill me. The second lie is always easier than the first, and the third is easier than the second, and so on. So once you start lying your way through life, it becomes a lifestyle. Lying becomes a characteristic of your life. And she, unfortunately, is exhibiting those qualities. Nevertheless, God uses her unrighteousness to save David, and he got away, and Saul's plot to drag the bed in there and kill him in the bed was thwarted by her activity. So he used Jonathan to try to protect David. He's used Michal, his wife, to try to protect David. Now he's going to use his old buddy Samuel, verse 18 of chapter 19. So David now fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him, and he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. Memorize all this real quick, like if you would, because I got to turn this off here in a minute and I can't show it to you again. This is a map that shows you the route of David's flight during his 10 years of fleeing from Saul. And I'll walk you through this. The first trek is right here. He was up here. When he fled from Saul, he goes up to Ramah, that little stretch right there, which is probably about 3 miles, maybe 2 or 3 miles. This is where Saul lives. This is where Samuel lives. Samuel lived in Ramah. Saul lives here in Gibeah. So David flees from here up to Samuel's place in Ramah. That's the first leg, just about a 2.5 mile jaunt from where he was. and he's staying in this place called Naoth. That's where the school of the prophets was. That's where all the guys who were being educated to be prophets lived. So you have a bunch of people there who are training to be prophets, and that's where they are. And of course, Samuel was the one of his sorts himself, and so he would know and they would know of him. So he's staying up there now. And David, and someone told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah." So Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. He turns them into prophets too. So he sends a SWAT team up there, and they're going to try to take David custody and bring him back. And when they get into the midst of that stuff, they start behaving as prophets. He makes them behave like the prophets there at the prophet school in Ramah. So that was told to Saul, verse 21. He sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So he sends another team up there, and God made prophets out of them. So Saul sent messengers again a third time, and they also prophesied. You'd be thinking that maybe he's getting the message by now, wouldn't you? So all of the different messengers he sent to take David captive, God turns them into prophets as well. So Saul goes himself, verse 22. He goes to Ramah, and he came as far as the large well that is in Siku, and he asked, "Well, where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Behold, they're at Naoth in Ramah." And he proceeded there in Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth in Ramah. The Spirit of God makes a prophet out of Saul. He acts and behaves just like the other guys. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? He too was prompted to behave in this abnormal manner that was typical of these prophets, and became just like them. It's like they're in the twilight zone, and you can't get in there without becoming a prophet. And so that didn't work. So God has protected David at this time using Samuel and the prophet school at Naoth. So Jonathan, Michael, Samuel, the prophet school. There's four good, clear-cut illustrations of God's intent to protect David from Saul. Now, we kind of criticize Saul for not getting the point. David probably ought to get the point by now, too, right? We see him now start to live by a principle that's not quite what we saw in the earlier part of his life. In the earlier part of his life, he was living by the principle of faith. I mean, he didn't take Goliath down by being fearful. And when he's walking by faith in life, God is blessing his life and he's doing great. But now he's starting to flee. Fear is creeping in to David's being, and he is running from Saul from fear. We'll see how that works out, okay? A little bit of change, a little bit of a chink in the armor that we've seen before starting to show up now in the life of David. Chapter 20. So David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "Well, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he's seeking my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me?" "It is not so," Jonathan says. So David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this,' but he has been grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. Your father is trying to kill me, whether you understand that or not." So Jonathan says to David, verse 4, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king." That is, they were going to have this normal monthly festival of a new moon, and he would be in Saul's presence and eating with him, as would all the other members of the court and so on. So it would be expected that David would be there with Saul at this feast the next day. He says, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. And if your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked to leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. So David says to Jonathan, Jonathan, would you lie to your father for me and tell him that I had to go back to my hometown, Bethlehem, to observe a family feast there. That's why I'm not at your feast here at the new moon. See what he's doing? He's asked his dear friend to lie for him because he's fearful. And if he says, it is good, your servant shall be safe, but if he's very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Saul's reaction to David's absence will be an indicator as to whether or not he intends to kill David. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant to a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father? And Jonathan said, be it from you, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? And Jonathan said to David, come and let us go into the field. So both men went out into the field. So they got this plan put together. David is not going to that feast with Saul. And he's asked Jonathan to lie for him to Saul about his whereabouts and to give him some feedback as to how Saul reacts to his absence. Then Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this tomorrow or about the third day, behold, if there's any good feeling toward David, shall I not then indeed send for you and make it known to you? And if it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. In other words, I'm going to help you either way. If it's good news, I'll let you know. If it's bad news, we'll get you sent away. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with me and my father. And if I'm still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? And you shall, this is Jonathan saying to David now, and you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Jonathan knows that David is going to one day sit on that throne, and he wants himself and his family to be protected against any sort of retaliation from David, which would be commonplace for succeeding realms. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord requite at the hands of David's enemies. And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as the Lord loved his own life. So these two have a covenant. Jonathan is not going to be harmed by David. Jonathan's family is not going to be harmed by David, if indeed this comes about. So Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And you have stayed for 3 days. When you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone of Ezel, this cave or wherever David hid before. He's going to hide there again. And I'll shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And behold, I will send the lad, saying, go find the arrows. And if I specifically say to the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them, then come. For there is safety for you and no harm as the Lord lives. So if he shoots his arrows in a certain place and tells the retriever, a young lad, to go get them because they're right in here, they'll know that everything is okay. But if I say to the youth, behold, the arrows are beyond you, go, for the Lord has sent you away. So if David hears Jonathan tell the youth, no, the arrows are further down, go get them, David is to flee because he knows it. Saul is going to kill him. So wherever Jonathan sends the lad to collect his arrows will indicate to David good or bad news that comes out of this ritual that he's going to skip. As far as the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food, and the king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. This is the wall that's got a bunch of holes in it now. At least 3 good big holes in it. And Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. It's obvious he ain't at Saul's table. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, well, it's an accident. He's not clean. Surely he is not clean. If he had had sexual activity right before, he couldn't. He was ceremonially unclean and could not come to the meal. And Saul says, yeah, that's probably what it is. So he doesn't pay a lot of attention to David's absence on the first day. It came about on the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal either yesterday or today? He doesn't even call him by his name, but he knew he wasn't there. So then Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He lies for David at David's request. For he said, please let me go since our family has sacrificed in the city and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now if I found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brothers. For this reason he has not come to the king's table. So Jonathan gives him this cockamamie story that they made up together about David having to go back to his own home for a feast, so he couldn't attend Saul's feast. And Saul doesn't believe him. Verse 30, Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. The terminology today would be similar, but it would be a little different. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? How long has the son of Jesse lives on earth? Neither you nor your kingdom will be established. As long, that is, he sees David as a threat to Jonathan if David takes over the throne. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be put to death? What has he done? So Jonathan continues to try to defend David's noble behavior before Saul. And Saul reacts to that by chucking a spear at him. This guy's solution to every problem in the world is to throw a spear at it. His own son. In front of these other guests and people. So Jonathan arose in fierce anger. He was very, very irate at his father for trying to strike him down because of his comments. And he didn't eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. I guess so. So Saul's madness now is extending not only past David, but to his own flesh and blood. This guy is a total fruitcake at this point in time. His mental health has deteriorated to a point where he could do this. Try to kill his own noble behaving son because of his affiliation and fondness with David. So it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the appointed time with David, and a little lad was with him, and he said to the lad, run, find the arrows which I'm about to shoot. And the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. The lad might want to run slowly enough that he doesn't get out there on the receiving end of one of those arrows, does he? So when the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan shot, Jonathan called after the lad, say, is not the arrow beyond you? Remember what that was going to signify? Bad. Things are bad, David. So Jonathan called after the lad, hurry, quick, do not stay. And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master, and the lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. So Jonathan gave the weapons to his lad and said, go to the city, take them into the city for me. And when the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. David knew now that the intention of Saul was still to kill him, as indicated by this little plot that they'd put together. So Jonathan said to David, go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. Then he rose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. And this marks the start of that chart right there. The 10 years of exile and the fleeing of Saul begins with this incident right here. While he's up there at, not too far, I guess, from Gibeah, on that chart. So what had happened now is that what started off as a good, loving relationship between David and Saul, one in which David was walking by faith and winning the admiration and esteem of the entire nation has deteriorated to this. Saul is determined to kill him. And David has begun to flee Saul, and fear is creeping into his thinking and is driving him. And he's starting to do other things. He's starting to lie. What's the opposite of the faith by which he was walking earlier? I just told you. Fear. Fear is the opposite of faith. It's not lack of faith. It's fear. And lying is an artifact of fear. We don't want to be caught. We don't want to be found out about something we're doing, so we lie. And so we're seeing in David now a change in the early character that we saw, and we're seeing him start to exhibit some properties of your normal sinful man, in that he is now walking not by the faith that we saw earlier, but by fear, and inevitably he starts to lie in that process. His wife is lying on his behalf. He's lying. He's getting his best friend in all the world to lie on his behalf. Is this a characteristic that he seems to possess and continue in later on in his life? Remember this dude named Uriah? Yeah, these lies become easier and easier, and the easier they become, the more they characterize your life. Your life becomes a lie. And David's life is full of lies. And we see them here early on. What is happening that has prompted him to stop walking by faith that we saw early to now walking by fear?
Desire.
Beg pardon?
Desire.
Well, he's certainly getting out of fellowship with the Lord, isn't he? The author to the book of Hebrews gives us about 5 different warnings in that book of what happens if we stray from walking in fellowship with the Lord, for being a branch in the vine that stays attached to the Lord, if our sanctification begins to fall apart and wane. And what happens is what we're seeing right here in David's life. He's going to drift. There's no danger of losing salvation, but there is danger in not progressing in terms of sanctification. There's a big debate in the Christian circles today about lordship salvation and perseverance of the saints, and what that means as compared to free grace salvation. And one camp says, well, you not only have to believe, but you have to also maintain your faith by continuing to allow the Lord to be the Lord of your life. And you have to persevere in your sanctification and not drift away. Otherwise, you're not saved, they say. And that is what David is doing here. But it's not the consequences of his activity have nothing to do with his salvation. It has to do everything with his sanctification. That issue is one involving sanctification. We can drift from the Lord. We can stray from him and lose a lot in terms of sanctification, lose reward, and so on. But we never lose our salvation. David's sanctification is waning. It's falling apart. It's coming undone. He's starting to live by the principle of fear, not faith. And he's lying. And there will be consequences to those lies, and we'll see them as we go along. So you see the change in the man's life? Early on last week, he was looking good. This week, he's starting to slide down that slippery slope where fear is gripping him, and inevitably fear leads to lying, and we'll see lying will lead to death, and it will just be a time of deterioration in David's life. These 10 years are not his best years. There's some good things in those, we'll see those, but there are some real problems that creep into his life that are indicative and instructive for all of us, in that they are just very, very typical, of course, of all of our lives, and we'll see those as we go along. So, see what I've seen so far. Now, it's quite a change, quite a transition from the first early years of David's life and service in Saul's court to what he's doing now as an enemy of Saul, fleeing for his life, but not really trusting the Lord for his protection, even though the Lord told him, look, showed him, I can use Jonathan to protect you, I can use your wife to protect you, I can use Samuel to protect you, and there will be others. He nevertheless is not trusting God. He's running based upon fear. See the change? More to come. Any questions or comments about anything we saw this morning? Yeah, Jane?
Okay. David's life was sort of characterized by being a man after God's own heart.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that was probably said later, but how can we still say that David's...
Well, I think the essence of that comparison is what we saw in his experience with Goliath. It offended David that God was being insulted by those heathens. He loved the things of God and esteemed the things of God highly. And so he said, I'm going to go out there and shut this guy up because he's insulting the God of Israel. So his heart was right toward God and the things of God. His life was prioritized correctly early on. Now, he's got these problems and these shortcomings, as we'll see as we go along. But I think that general attitude is probably what is at stake there when his heart is like God's heart. He loved the things of God. He, like all men, at times fell and failed. But basically, unlike Saul, who loved Saul, selfish, jealous, egotistical maniac, David loved the things of God and persisted in that, I think, throughout his life in spite of these other problems we'll see. So I don't think they necessarily negate that statement. It's just a case of specific failures that we all exhibit. But nevertheless, he highly esteemed the things of God. So we'll see more as we go along. We got quite a bit more of incidents in his life to see. But so far, we've seen a transition, an unfortunate transition from walking by faith to walking by fear, and it has resulted in some negative things for David, to be sure. Any other questions or comments? Tommy.
Yeah. I can't see that being in fear doesn't mean you still have faith.
If you fear something, you won't react to it in the same way you do if you're living by faith. Faith and fear are mutually exclusive. You don't react by faith when you react by fear. They're the opposite things. When you trust God, you do not fear. When you trust yourself or something else, you can fear. But those two things are mutually exclusive. There's some passages that I could show you, but I can't think of them right offhand, or would you, that unfortunately. Well, if I let you go now, you can be home in time for the Cowboy game. Don't speed. You have plenty of time. All right, we'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing.